This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Alison Milden,
Maurice Clark,
and I'm Vicky Marie Buchanan. So welcome back, Maurice.
Thank you.
You have done heaps of work in the community. So tell us about that.
Well, it just happened, really. I've always been someone that has thought that if you've got the skills and abilities and there's a need, then you should actually step up and be involved. It's all very well for people to sort of see that there's an issue or a problem or something that needs to be done and sit and mutter and mumble about it. You've actually got to take that next step and put yourself out there and do things. And so I've always thought, right, well, if there's a need and I can be helpful, I will be helpful.
Mm.
And I guess that partly goes back to where I was brought up and how I was brought up. When you live out in a rural community, you have to rely on the people around you because you don't instantly have assistance or help available, and you're used to working together cooperatively. And I had around me adults that were engaged in their community, like my father was actively involved in the Lions Club, and I remember when I was a lot smaller he coached the rugby team at Newbury School for a couple of years, and he was actively involved in Young Farmers when he was a young man, and if somebody needed a hand, Dad would actually step up and do it. And my mother was involved in the Women's Institute and the St. Luke's Guild out at Kairanga, and so did those sorts of works. And I remember my grandmother, that's my mum's mother, being very actively involved in supporting the church fairs at All Saints Church. You go going and visit, go in and visit Gran at the weekends before the church fairs, and the back bedroom in her house, the beds would be covered in hand-knitted toys and stuffed toys and things that she had made for sale at the church sales, because Gran had pretty nasty arthritis, but she could still knit and sew and do those things, whereas she couldn't do the physical stuff. So, and then there was Alison's mother, actually, when I was a teenager, and she was, I knew she was actively involved in a lot of things, and the one that comes to mind is the Manawatu Sinfonia and Youth Orchestra, and she was really proactive with promoting those. And when I was a teenager, she conned me or coerced me into doing the posters and displays at the library with her for the upcoming concerts. So sort of from quite early, I had these adults around that showed that, you know, you get out there and you do things, and it just came naturally to do it. The first time I got actively involved in anything voluntary was St. Luke's Church out at Kairanga, and there was a need for a Sunday school teacher, so I would have been about 15 or 16 at the time. And along with Mrs. Daphne Hyde, we used to do the Sunday school. I did that up until I started working in town as a nurse, and then didn't do an awful lot of voluntary work during the early years of my nursing training because, you know, you're doing the shift work, you're tired, you're studying, and there's you basically don't have much of a social life. Then when I married and had young children, well, my first little child, I got I got conned into being part of Plunkett, and it was very, very insidious, actually.
Yes.
First of all, was would you like to deliver some newsletters for us?
Yeah.
So I can do that, you know, put the baby in the pushchair and whip round
Wheel
the
them around
and do that. And, oh, hey, we've got some raffle tickets. Would you like to see? Oh, yes, sure. Yeah, I can do that. We've got a committee meeting coming up. Would you like to come on the committee? And, well, the rest was history there. And so that, for my part of here working in town and being involved in community stuff, Plunkett was the actual ingress point, really. And so I initially joined the Roslyn sub-branch of Plunkett, and before I knew it, I was the chairperson of the Roslyn sub-branch. That, you know, that didn't take long. That ended up being, you know, 18 months in. And then, of course, when you're the chairperson, you've got to go along to the branch meetings in Palmerston North, because there's like nine sub-branches, and you've all got to go once a month in there. And next minute, I ended up being the chair of the Palmerston North branch. And, oh, by the way, we need a representative on the National Council of Women group locally, so off you go to do that. I mean, at this point I had only one child and was only doing a little bit of part-time work, so it wasn't quite so tricky juggling things. And you go on to the National Council of Women as part of Plunkett, and it was, oh, we haven't had such a young member for a long time.
They love it.
Time.
So is this the spanning decades? Is this
No, this is a decade? This isn't even a decade yet.
So when is this? Is this the...
This is so from... I had my first child when I was 23.
Mm.
So this was sort of 23 to... But this is in about 4 or 5 year period here.
You're right,
23.
They're moving, getting you involved, aren't they?
Getting involved, all right. And then the ladies on the National Council of Women obviously saw an opportunity, and next minute I was the secretary for them, doing their minutes and things like that. And so Miss Elizabeth Sevilla was the chairperson at the time, and she just lived down the road from me, which was really good. So, you know, I'd trot down the road with the baby and go and see Elizabeth, and we'd sort out the minutes. And then... And around that time also there was Bernardo's doing... I was a consumer representative on Bernardo's.
Mm.
That came slightly later when I had my second child. Mm. And also there was a group that started up called New Mothers Support Group.
Right.
And I was a bit involved with those in the early days.
So is that the 80s, 90s?
This is the mid-80s.
Mid-80s,
so my eldest child was born in 1985. So this is roughly 1985 through to about 1991.
Mm. Yeah.
In 1991 I had number two child. And so when she was born, she had the most grandparents in Palmerston North because of all of the ladies on the National Council of Women. I was the youngest by about... there was one other younger woman on there who would have been in her 40s.
Right.
And then there was me, and the rest of these ladies were 60-plus.
Yes,
and
they
were some of the really... They were the likes of... Mrs. Sexton, whose husband was involved in the running of the hospital.
Okay.
And that was Lorna Sexton, and oh golly, some of the other names elude me now. Wyn Marden and Leslie Sixtus. Leslie Sixtus was there. So, you know, these are some of the women that were integral in
The community, very
women's
much.
Issues within the community. And as part of that group, they look at what you do and what have you out in the community. And because I was a nurse, oh right, you can be our health representative, feed into the national stuff there. So that was all happening in a very short time frame. Sort of, this was between 1985 and 1990. won.
Right. I'm just picking up on what you've just said because it was helping with women's issues. Not a movement, but do you think there was a real need for women's support that was different from previous years, earlier years? What was changing?
What was changing there was the push for us as young women to be back in the workforce. That was a huge thing going on at that time. You know, as soon as you had your child, everyone's asking, when are you going back to work? When are you going back to work?
I had that.
And it was, and there was a lot of, and there was also, like at that point, the older women, like in our mothers' age groups, were returning to the workforce.
Yes.
So the younger women did not have the older women there that they would have had to draw on and have and support when they. So there was a lot of challenges around young women needing help, support, guidance in the community. And during that, it was during that time also that I worked part-time for Plunkett. I did my Plunkett nursing training and I was studying also, started a bachelor's degree during that time. And it was really, really clear that there were these big gaps in the community for women who were having babies and needing help, but the help wasn't necessarily
there. Who was
there.
Putting the pressure on the women in the 85-ish to go back to work? Was it just cost pressures?
It was cost pressures. It was the
big interest rates then, wasn't it?
Absolutely, because the interest rates were absolutely phenomenal, and it had gone from being, being able to be supported on one income because wages were not keeping pace with the cost of living, and the interest rates were really high. And I mean, when I took out the mortgage for this place, which would have been in about 1990-ish, the interest rates were ridiculous.
They were
at
up
that
in the
stage.
They were up in 12% or something.
They were
14%.
Yes, they were.
I remember that. I was 1983. I had to wean my newborn baby and go back to work off maternity leave, and I was one of the first women to go back off maternity leave. And the comments that I got from the men in the workplace because I was leaving my baby at home and going back to work.
You were caught between a rock and a hard
really
place
were.
Because you were being pressured to be back at work. But you were the worst person in the whole wide world for abrogating your responsibility for your child.
And it was a tough time.
Yeah, the thing is, though, there's a consequence for every social change that's pushed for. So, of course, women had pushed to be able to work, etc., etc., post-war, that kind of thing. There's a consequence.
There was also issues with a little bit again, like we had post-COVID, where there were jobs but not the people to fill them. Because when I first registered as a nurse back in about 1983, we had a glut of nurses. Well, they weren't employing. They were the same kind of rubbish that's going on now. They weren't employing. So the majority of my class did not get work. There was they only employed out of my group, they only employed about 10 of us.
Yeah,
the rest
that's shocking.
Of them did not have jobs, which was awful. And so we lost this huge cohort of nurses overseas. Many of them stayed away, didn't come back to New Zealand. So by the time, sort of the early 90s, there was a different issue. They were short and they were scrambling around. So we were being pressured to be back in the workforce at that point. But then we got another change in government and nurses were being seen as the the drain on the health system. Sound familiar?
Yes, very severe. Yes, yeah,
that's
very.
Exactly what's being said now. It's exactly the same rhetoric. Well, nurses are always going to be probably one of the largest costs in the workforce because we're the largest part of the healthcare workforce. And there's no other way around it. And I remember during that time, I know we've strayed away from the voluntary community kind of work here, but during that time there was big pressure on, and there was going to be user pays in the healthcare system, hospital part charges, all that kind of hoo-ha. That was a nightmare and a half. They were looking at cost cutting in the hospitals, same as they are now. And I remember an accountant sitting there, I was a union delegate at this stage, sitting there and looking at us nurses and saying that the nurses were a cost to the organisation. They did not generate income and they needed to be cut.
Oh my goodness.
Because it was all about generating income.
Yes,
So we were seen as a burden on the health system, and that same rhetoric is coming through today. We're being told that we are expecting too much and we don't deserve to be paid what we are, and that there's too many of us, etc., etc. It's like the 1990s revisited. And in the midst of all of this, you've got patients that are needing to be cared for, and what we've got is a real challenge at the present because we've got all of us that are older coming through. We're that baby boom generation. There's that big bulge in there, and there is going to be that pressure on the system, and we do need to be making sure that the system can manage it. COVID highlighted the problem.
And there'll be more.
And, it'll settle down after we've all died, but at the moment you've got this big bulge in the system. Privatising health, it's not the way to go. That was sort of from 1985 through to 1991. I was doing all of that kind of stuff, and I went back to work full time in 1991 when my youngest child was only 5 months old, because we needed an income in the household. I was the breadwinner in the household, so she was 5 months old. I went back to work full time, and so the things like the Plunkett and the National Council of Women had to be stopped at that point. But it was not long after that that. But I always kept an eye on what was happening community wise, and was just wasn't as active for a couple of years there when I went back to work full time. Then the city council thought it was a good idea to turn the pit into something else. And
so this is the, is it called the pit?
Well, colloquially it's called the pit. Yes. Its official name now is Edwards Pit Park.
Right.
But in those days it was just the pit. And it had been that to generations of kids. Like when I was at high school, it was the pit. It would have been the same for you, wouldn't it, Alison?
Yes, was it a quarry?
It was a quarry.
It was a quarry,
It was a quarry. And there had been obviously some discussions within City Council about it because they owned the site.
Right.
And they were going to give consent, non-notified consent, to a developer to turn it into a motorised go-karting venue. And at the time, a couple of the city councillors, the late Roni Fitzmaurus and Heather Tangay, who's now up in Auckland, thought this was completely wrong because around the pit is a residential area. This is an old state housing area here.
Right.
And some of it was still state housing, some of it was privately owned, and then you've got the high school behind it, and they were just going to give a non-notified consent to the developer to turn it into motorised go-karts.
Gosh, imagine.
So,
Heather, really thinking about the needs of the community.
No.
Yeah, not.
No. Well, we won't go into how much of a backroom boys' deal it was going to be, but it was. And Heather and Ronnie were horrified by this and actually did a note, a letterbox drop to let the community know that this was proposed, because this had all been discussed in part two of the council meetings.
Oh.
It hadn't been discussed in the public arena because, of course, commercial sensitivity.
Yes, yes.
And they called a public meeting to discuss it. And, of course, you know, those of us that were interested in such things,
We should say we're sitting in your lounge area and looking out at this beautiful park here, so it would be right over your fence.
It was right over the back fence. And they called a public meeting, and the Scout Hall up on Andrew Avenue was full. So the community was a bit perturbed about this.
Yeah.
And the upshot of that meeting was that there was nobody within the community that wanted such a development, and the council realised that maybe they had goofed ever so slightly, and it was an election year. It's always good to have these things happen in an election year. And so... anyhow, it became an election year issue, because it was bad press, and you've never seen city councillors change their tack
so quickly.
There was one city councillor at the meeting that was at the public meeting that was arguing for it, and was a bit naive. I didn't know who this man was, let alone that he was a city councillor. And I'd started talking, and this man interrupted and tried to talk over. And well, I'm used to dealing with stroppy doctors at the hospital, so this was nothing. So I told the person to actually please sit down and be quiet. It was he had already spoken, and this was my speaking time. And it got back to me later who it was that I told to sit down and be quiet. It had caused a great deal of hilarity amongst the city councillors, because this person was known to over-talk people, and he'd never been told to do that
before. Oh, well done you.
I did that. He and I are still on very good terms to this day, but it was... It was quite amusing, you know. They got back, this member of the community told so-and-so to sit down and be quiet.
And he did.
He did.
He did.
He did. I think he got a bit of a surprise.
All credit to him. He did.
Particularly when I directly asked him the question, because he was arguing for the development, and I said to him, can you sit there and honestly tell me that you would want this over your back fence? No, he goes. And I said, well, then why should the people in Roslyn have that over their back fence? I said, we're not against the proposal per se, it's just in the wrong place. It was the wrong place for that kind of thing. Utterly wrong place. So anyhow, the upshot of it was the city councillors, a lot of them reversed their decision, and then they came back and said, and came back to the community, because we got a bit active and, you know, delivering things in mailboxes and petitions and things like that. And there was a sort of a core group and became loosely known as the Pitt Park people. And the upshot of it was the council came back and said, right, if you don't want that in there, what do you want? And there was a wide community consultation.
Wow.
And there was also a change of mayor. This came up to the elections, and the old mayor was retiring, and new mayor came in. And we had a mayor that was positive towards the project. And a report was commissioned, and there was citywide consultation, and the upshot of it was the community, apart from the soccer community who were a bit peeved because they wanted soccer fields down there, the community made it very, very clear that they wanted a park that had native plants in it, and that it wasn't formally planted out, like you know, garden beds and things like that. They wanted something that was going to replicate the natural bush. And that's how we ended up with the kind of park that we're developing down there now.
Good vision, wasn't it?
So this was, this is 20-odd years ago now.
So that's 2000, this, just on 2000?
No, about 1990... About 1998-ish, it was,
That's good. It was good vision of them, wasn't it? And good on them turning their ideas around. Well, let's look forward to hearing about the development of that in the next one.
Right.
This is part 5 of 6. Listen next week for part 6.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.